This is Civic Media, bringing you news, talk, and community-minded conversations all across Wisconsin. You can find us at civicmedia.us and download the app for free today. Hi, I'm Jimmy Cusco, sports director for Civic Media. Right now, we're airing a Packers, Badgers, Brewers, or Bucks game over the air, but due to our rights agreements, we're not able to stream those games here. Civic Media might be a newer company, but we are dedicated to providing the best in sports coverage. Our team has decades of experience covering sports right here in Wisconsin. We've got Mike Clemens, who covers our state's biggest teams on location and does daily updates on all of our Civic Media stations statewide. Many of our stations have local reporters dedicated to teams in their area, covering their community dozens or even hundreds of times each year. No matter where you're at in Wisconsin, we are committed to covering sports, especially in the communities that our stations serve. And we put all of our local coverage right here on our stream, so you can go ahead and grab the free Civic Media app so you never miss a game at civicmedia.us/app. You can find the game you're looking for over the air, or you can stay tuned right here on the stream for more news, talk, and conversation. Thank you for listening to Civic Media from all of us here on the sports team.
You can always continue the conversation on social media. Share your thoughts when you find and follow Civic Media on Facebook, X, and Instagram.
Civic Media News, I'm Derek Tritz. Here's what Wisconsin needs to know. Friday is an important day in court for Robert F. Kennedy. He's trying to get off the Wisconsin ballot. The Elections Commission and previous courts have ruled that under state law, the only way for non-party candidates to be removed is to die. Friday, Kennedy's team and the Wisconsin Elections Commission will file briefs with their arguments in the 2nd District Court of Appeals. Kennedy is trying to get his name off the ballot so his supporters are more likely to vote for former President Donald Trump. In an act of bravery, a 12-year-old boy saved his dad from a bear attack here in Wisconsin. Ryan Bierman and his son Owen were up near Siren, a village in Burnett County. They were hunting and had shot the bear from a tree stand. When they went down to track it, the bear spotted Ryan and charged him. Thinking quickly, 12-year-old Owen grabbed his gun and shot the bear, killing it and saving his dad's life. And that's what you need to know. I'm Derek Tritz, and this is Civic Media News.
The Todd Alba Show.
Troy, our grand prize winner from that Just a Bit Outside the Movie Text to Win contest out in beautiful Mount Horeb.
You gotta go see this movie. You know, you'll laugh, you'll cry. I know that sounds cliche, but it's true.
It is.
The no narrator was perfect for this movie, and that's what made the movie. Yeah. Seeing the players in their own words telling these stories.
The Todd Alba Show. Weekdays, noon till 2 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app.
Covering the games and biggest sports news, listen daily to Mike Clemens on Civic Media.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
It's time for the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here today on the big program. Lots to get to, lots to talk about. It was 47 years ago today that the residents of Youngstown, Ohio, were crushed by the devastating news that the Youngstown Steel and Tube Company were going to be closing its doors. In Youngstown, it's known as Black Monday. And that's the moment that many point to the end of an era for a community that had thrived on steel production since like the late 19th century. I remember, and look, I was 10 years old when this happened. I remember reading this in the headlines as a kid, because I delivered newspapers like a lot of kids my age, or of my generation especially, and the pain from that announcement wasn't just in Youngstown. It was felt in Cleveland, just 75 miles down the road. And this is the story of, you know, consolidation and corporate downsizing and deindustrialization and union busting. This was kind of the beginning in that area that, you know, wreaked havoc on communities. And look, it sent shockwaves across Youngstown and Northeast Ohio. Youngstown had built its identity around the steel mills and the hardworking families and the communities that relied on that mill, like many communities across this country. And in 2022, we went to a lot of those places that used to be places like Youngstown. But back then, 1977, this closure meant over 5,000 people would lose their jobs. And the ripple effect that comes from that, much more extensive. Sure, you had the 5,000 plus families who worked in the mill were attached to that job, depending on that steady income, those health benefits, that retirement security, all of that stuff. And for generations had that security of knowing that, hey, I can go to the mill. That the fallback was always, you know, if something doesn't work out, I can always go to the mill. And, you know, the people who, you know, had that security now facing uncertainty, despair, and understand the economic impact was immediate. All of those businesses that fed into the mill closed. All of the businesses that, because of the money that the workers earned, Main Street, those all shut down. The local shops, the local restaurants, all that stuff done. And what had been once a vibrant community, now basically set on fire with unemployment and poverty and high crime rates and all of the negative stuff when incomes are lost. The social fabric began to unravel in Youngstown. You know, the pride that came with that mill being there was replaced by a sense of loss. And this is not just Youngstown, but across the country as this happened. And I say all the time, I grew up with a front row seat to us deindustrializing and destroying what our grandparents' generation had built, which was the most prosperous working class in the history of humanity. And we did it so corporate America could have a little bit more. And what happened to these communities, and I don't think we talk enough about it, you know, because Youngstown loses the mill immediately. You have all this negative stuff. And then people start leaving. And you have a disintegration of not just the population, but of the local infrastructure. Schools can't be funded anymore. So you've got problems there. Cultural institutions that used to thrive, nope, gone. Now you just have despair. And, you know, in the face of adversity, look, the community, you know, rallied. Local, activists and leaders, they did what they could to get displaced workers job training and economic development initiatives to try and replace some of the loss. But understand, as much as they could do, didn't replace what that was. You had what was, in essence, economic terrorism going on because corporate America wanted more. And, you know, while we can talk about the lessons of perseverance and, you know, their stick-to-itiveness, because Youngstown is still forging their way, the scars of Black Monday still linger. And for many, it represents not just the loss of jobs, but the erosion of a way of life. And while I'm talking about Youngstown in this moment, you could put this in any number of cities across this country. Everyone knows the day the factory closed down. Everyone knows the day that the community turned away from the things that brought us together and made us a better community to the things that made us worse. Now, look, you know, 1977, you've got the Youngstown Sheet and Tube Company. They would say, well, we're closing our doors. A couple years later, 2 years later, 79, U.S. Steel closed its Ohio works. Then the Briar Hill factory went down. 95, you had Republic Steel gone. Basically, the era of steel in Youngstown over. And, you know, I guess the one thing that you could say came out of it is Bruce Springsteen wrote the song Youngstown, about the idea, about talking about bringing down the Sweet Jenny, the furnace that had been the symbol of Youngstown and also the symbol of its economic ruin. But again, I come back to a lot of communities we went to, the remnants of a proud past are still there. And you go, well, why are you telling us this? Because we can fix this. Bad policy allowed this to happen. Perverse incentives for corporate America allowed this to happen. We can collectively, through our government, ensure that it doesn't. And ultimately, you know, the initial move, what historians have told me is it was a massive cost-cutting thing. They went to a non-union area. They moved to Indiana. They consolidated. They took advantage of synergy and eliminated redundancy. And what that meant is a community screwed so that the corporation could have more. And you go, but Rick, that's how business is done. And yeah, I get that. But I remember that era. And again, I was just a kid reading it on the front pages of the newspaper. But every day you saw the wealth class of this country protecting themselves and enriching themselves at the expense of everyone else. And sadly, what came of this is the messaging that came out of it is, well, the unions did this because the unions demanded too much. And it's amazing that we've taken that. The fact that workers believe that they should have some gain in the wealth that their labor creates is, to me, fundamental. But amazing that some folks would be, that's bad. Now they ran off to Indiana. For me, the rule would have been, yeah, we're going to tax you. We're going to not allow Indiana to be a no rights at work state. Sounds reasonable, sane, because we shouldn't be pitting people against each other on who's willing to be more desperate and work for poverty wages. And that's what we saw in the 70s and 80s. This kind of hooray, race to the bottom, hooray for me and the heck with everyone else. But I thought this would be an interesting story for today. Today on the program, we're going to talk with a few of the, we're going to play a couple of the interviews that we did while we were at the DNC. Dana Nessel, the Michigan Attorney General, Virginia Representative Jennifer McClellan, and Baltimore Mayor Brandon Scott going to give us some thoughts. Going to take a quick break right back after this. Stick around. Be sure to follow us on Twitter at Rick Smith Show. Like us on Facebook, Instagram, and subscribe to our YouTube channel.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and DC government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So as we sit here in the convention hall, grabbing people as they come by, I had to reach out and grab Dana Nessel, who is the Attorney General in Michigan. You may remember, we've had Dana on a couple of times back when our Working Class Heroes tour went through Flint, Michigan. She was gracious enough to come visit us at the fabulous farmers market that was there. Also, she's been on the program talking about her recidivism program or non-recidivism program. I'm glad to see her, and I'm glad she took time to sit down with us. Dana, thanks for being here.
So great to talk to you again. It's amazing to be here.
So you were on the big stage there, made a little news.
Yeah, it was such an honor. The Harris campaign reached out a few weeks ago and asked me if I wanted to speak, and I mean, I'm a lawyer and a politician, so of course my answer was that I'd be thrilled to do it. I've been working as a surrogate on the ground in Michigan for Vice President Harris, and it's so easy to do when you have a candidate that you feel so, you know, sincere about and strong about. And I just know she's going to be an amazing president. I'm really looking forward to it.
I mean, the history of, you know, this is the first woman president, the history of the first black woman president. There's a lot of firsts there.
Oh, yeah.
Does that matter?
Yeah, of course it matters. Okay. Of course it matters. You know, my whole life I've been waiting to have a female president. I mean, you know, it's important, that representation. And I can think of no one better to serve in that role. And I will say this, you know, it means a lot to me to have a former attorney general in that role. And one of the things I've come to appreciate is just all the different types of work that you do protecting various different sects of people, right? So, you know, workers and students and seniors and consumers, and the list really goes on and on. I think it's just an absolute incredible element of her resume. And of course, she's got a lengthy one, right? But I also like that she was a bad prosecutor. You know, I holding people accountable in all different types of ways, you know, criminal and civil alike, you know, so whether you're talking about corporations that would rip people off, or whether you're talking about, you know, serial rapists, you know, she's somebody who knows how to get the job done, and she knows how to make sure that everyone is treated equally under the law. And that's what we are missing in her opponent, right?
Well, he's crazy. I mean, I don't know what's going on between his ears, but every day it's some kind of new chaos. It's some kind of new bit of, I'm not sure desperation is the right word. You know, word salad, diarrhea, I don't know. But I don't want 4 years of that.
I don't want 4 minutes of that. I mean, we're exhausted from him, you know? The fact that he's even still around, of course, I think is very disappointing. So many of us, you know, when we saw Joe Biden sworn into office, we just thought, thank God, we are done with that guy. And to me, it really reminds me of a Friday the 13th movie where you're like, oh, good, we're done with Jason. He's gone. He's taken care of. And then he just keeps coming back again and again and again. You're like, oh, my God, still is this happening? So our long national nightmare has not yet ended. But, you know, I mean, we're fighting back as hard as we can with a really quality candidate who I think is going to do a phenomenal job.
I hope so. Look. This national nightmare is not going to end when we beat Trump in November. My fear is that it just morphs into something crazier. And the only way that we fix this is we make people's lives better. And, you know, as you've talked about your anti-recidivism program, when people start doing better, when they have better opportunities in their lives, when their kids have better school opportunities, they don't want to do dumb stuff. And I look at the same thing with the Red Hats. They are struggling in a lot of cases. They've been tightening the belt. The paycheck hasn't been going as far. It seems to me that if we were to help some of those, people wouldn't be so crazy.
Well, but let me say this. I think a lot of it is a state of mind, right? I mean, from an objective standard, we know that people are better off under the Biden administration, the Biden-Harris administration, than they were under the Trump administration. I mean, there's no doubt about that.
I am better off right now than I was 4 years ago today.
Yeah, most of us are. And I hate the fact that, you know, it's like an infection, you know, him getting up there and convincing people that they're not doing as well as they really are. I mean, we know that people, you know, our employment rate has skyrocketed. We know that people are making more money. We know that more people have health insurance. I mean, these are objective facts, and that doesn't mean that people aren't still struggling, but it means that, you know, we're making progress. And what we see in Donald Trump is this nonstop effort to convince people that there are wrongs that don't necessarily exist, and to villainize people who aren't doing anything to harm them. If I can tell the story, I was, you know, I obviously we have issues at the border. I think everybody agrees with that. And certainly, you know, we've had efforts by President Biden and Vice President Harris to fix that. Unfortunately, we have Donald Trump, who, of course, you know, the Republican Party is at his beck and call. When he says, this is bad for my campaign, you know, don't pass a border bill, they don't, you know, they listen to him because it's like a cult.
A border bill that was promoted by one of the most ultra-conservative members of the Senate.
That's right. But I was talking to a woman who works in my office at the Michigan Department of Attorney General. And, you know, we were having a conversation about the election, and I said, what is motivating you? What do you think about in terms of, like, what issue is most pronounced to you? And she said, oh, well, I'm really worried about all the issues on the southern border. Now, remember, we live in Michigan. So we are, you know, I can drive 20 minutes from my house into Windsor, Canada. That's how close we are. And so I asked her, I go, well, out of curiosity, like, how is that impacting your life, right? What if you have, like, undocumented folks that are somehow finding their way up here, you know, has someone in your family lost a job because of that? And she said, no. I said, has anybody been physically harmed because of that? And she said, no. And I go, well, how has it actually affected you then? And she goes, well, I just see all this stuff on TV and I hear all these people talking about it. I go, but that's not reality. That's not your real life. I go, let me ask you this. Do you have anyone in your family that has outstanding student loans and they're hanging around like an albatross around their neck and they're not able to, you know, get a home or afford a car or a vehicle when they need it? She goes, yeah, I know a lot of people like that. I go, okay, well, do you have anybody who had a recent health scare and they're having problems with their insurance covering whatever their recent diagnosis is? And she said, oh, yeah, no, we've had that. And I was like, but then why? I don't understand. Like, those are things that you should be concerned about. Those are things that are actually impacting your life that Democrats, of course, are actively trying to fix and to make better. But here you are, you're scared about something that has never actually impacted your life in any way, shape, or form, because that's all the Republicans have. They have scare tactics, and they convince people that, you know, there are threats all over the place that don't exist, and they distract from the actual threats that are there and that we really should be working together to improve people's lives on.
No, we've been sold on this idea that MS-13 is around every corner when the real threat is 900 pages of Project 2025. And now the line that you had in your speech about your ring, I thought was important, because there are real attacks on people who are just trying to get by day after day.
Yeah, you know, so I was part of the team that went to the United States Supreme Court to achieve marriage equality. And you might remember that was a Sixth Circuit case. One of those cases was from Michigan. That was my case. And I got to say, I mean, like, the way that my life changed for the better, because I was in a legal marriage and my wife could legally adopt our children we were raising together, it made all the difference in the world in a myriad of ways. But what people had been trying to scare people about same-sex marriage for years is, like, something bad is going to happen to your family if other families have the opportunity to have a legal marriage. And here we are now, right? That was in 2015. I'm happily married for 9 years. Like, what bad thing happened to other people?
And I've got a story for that. You know, I'm a truck driver, and we used to run up north in the New England states with a convoy of guys. And one day, the issue came up on the TV while we were having lunch. And a guy goes, oh, you've heard it. You know, they're going to ruin the sanctity of my marriage. And I said, whoa, wait a second. Hold on. Those are people you have no idea who they are. And that's going to ruin the sanctity of your marriage. Is that what you're saying? But the girlfriend that you have in Brockton with the child that your wife doesn't know about, somehow that's not going to affect the sanctity of your marriage?
But this is what I'm saying. You know, it's these scare tactics, and they're meant to divide us instead of uniting us as a country. We should all be getting behind things like, you know, better paying jobs and good insurance and making sure that, you know, people can afford a quality education and have clean air and clean water. I mean, these are things that all of us together should be standing united and saying collectively for these things. But because the Republicans and because Donald Trump, they don't have any good ideas. They have to create these scare tactics that create a divided nation. And I think that irrespective of what we see in the future in terms of Donald Trump, I mean, this is going to affect our nation for many years to come. And I hope and I pray that we're able to someday put the pieces back together. And I want to be able to go to the supermarket and look around and not have to wonder, is that a Trump supporter? Is that a Trump supporter? Do they hate me?
Yeah.
Just for no reason, not because I've done anything to harm them, just because, you know, in their minds, oh, the Democrats. And, you know, we didn't used to be like that. And I will say, I remember working in this gigantic courthouse in downtown Detroit. I worked there for decades. And you had Republicans and you had Democrats, and we just mingled.
You went through your day.
We went through our day. We never thought about it. Yes, around election time, maybe we'd have a discussion here or there. But we didn't hate each other.
Yeah.
We'd just be like, here's my guy, here's your guy, and I'm going to vote, and then I'll see you. Let's have a drink tonight. And that was it.
Yeah, well, they're now wearing the hat. They bought the shirt. They're kind of invested.
They have this man's name on a flag, right? I mean, listen,
what?
in the olden days, right, I would support Barack Obama, and during election season, I'd put a sign up on my lawn.
A month before the election.
And then when the election was over, I'd take the sign down. I didn't have flags on my house or my truck or boat or whatever. I mean, I didn't worship this person. I supported him. I voted for him. But, you know, he wasn't like a god to me.
I say all the time, I don't agree with myself 100% of the time. I'm never going to agree with a politician 100% of the time. So, you know, this hero worship that only Trump can solve things is very scary. Now, you said something a moment ago that triggered this thought that, you know, that line that we all do better when we all do better. And this comes back to what's being done here at this convention. The fact that labor is front and center in almost everything. The idea that we should be fighting for better wages, hours, conditions, opportunities. That plays in a whole bunch of arenas, on the Red Hat arena, in places where people are incarcerated. To me, that's the way forward.
Absolutely, and you know, but it's very clear, right? It is Democrats who have protected workers' rights, and you know, I look at whether you're talking about the provisions of Project 2025 that would eliminate overtime pay. Whether you're talking about one of the things that have been really important to us at our office is eliminating these ridiculous non-compete clauses for everybody.
Yep.
And I mean, I concede that in certain specific...
Very, very specific.
Narrow...
But making sandwiches at Jimmy John's should not have a non-compete.
Exactly, you know. But here, of course, I mean, look at the Trump administration. They think everybody should be held to account under a non-compete clause. And I mean, I remember during COVID, I mean, we had nurses that wanted to work in different hospitals. They wanted to help as many people as possible, and they were literally prohibited from doing so because of the non-compete clauses. They're
That's crazy.
You know, they're general nurses that, you know, are RNs, and they just go help people when they're sick, and they can't do it because of those clauses. And that's what the Trump administration wants to bring back. I mean, the Biden administration, the Harris administration, they've tried so hard to eliminate this. But, I mean, you could talk about this over and over again. I don't think people understand how this affects their everyday life. And that's why I'm so proud to be a Democrat, and I am a lifelong Democrat, because we are the party that cares about everyone, especially workers, and wants to protect them. And I am going to say, you know, I was really... It kind of broke my heart a little bit when I saw the president of the Teamsters even addressing the RNC. Because I'm like, man, what are you doing? Especially because Biden, of course, had worked so hard to help the Teamsters with some issues that they had.
But saved our pensions.
Yeah. I mean, it was unbelievable to me. I'm like, why are you even there? What for what? You know? And then, of course, it was shortly after that Trump does that, I don't know what to call it, the interview with Elon Musk. Talks about people going on strike, and I like you because you'll just fire them.
They're all gone.
What? And you want to support someone like that?
Well, he wasn't supporting them. He was going into the belly of the beast to take a message. And I'm like, I'm not against that. I do that all the time. I'm against the forum in which he did it. It was stupid to be on the RNC stage because that's about getting Trump elected. End of story. Nobody's going to remember what Sean O'Brien said. They're going to remember that he was there and called him a tough SOB. That's it. And that's why I said, look, I told the, you know, all the news organizations, he was their dancing show pony, that they're going to ride him all the way to the election.
Well, I hope that he has some deep regrets at this point.
He's doubled down. In fact, he was on Fox News making jokes about the Postal Service.
Wow. Well, it's so disappointing, you know, but I don't know. All we can do is keep fighting.
No, we just organize. We move forward. So last question I've got for you, because I like you. I like you as Attorney General. I think you're doing amazing work, just like I think Kamala Harris did as Attorney General. How do I start the Dana Nessel for Attorney General of the U.S.? How do I start
that? You know, future President Harris has a wide variety of amazing lawyers to choose from. I'm just going to put this plug in, even though it's totally inappropriate to do so, but... I'm a fangirl of Tish James from New York. I think she's one of the most exceptional attorneys I've ever had the pleasure of working with.
And boy, would that drive the right crazy.
And, I mean, if I had to pick, I am telling you, she is such a bad She is fearless. She's afraid of no one. But beyond that, she's just a good person. And she is the least hypocritical person I've ever met in office. I mean, when she tells you something, she means it. And, you know, I would love to see somebody like her in that position. I'm not telling future President Harris what to do or not do. I'm just saying, if you're talking about AGs, boy, we have some really good ones, and she's the best of the best, in my opinion.
Do not sell yourself short. I think you're amazing, and I appreciate you taking some time for us. I hope you'll come back and talk to us again.
I sure will. Thank you so much.
Great seeing you. Michigan Attorney General Dana Nessel. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. Gonna take a quick break. Right back here from the convention.
Saving work in America, one show at a time. The Rick Smith Show.
You're listening to News from the Center, WRCE. Enjoying this local program? Find the complete Civic Media lineup at civicmedia.us or the Civic Media app.
I'm meteorologist Mace Michaels. Scattered showers and thunderstorms this evening, some severe, large hail the biggest concern. Partly cloudy overnight, low in the low 60s. For tomorrow, mostly sunny, less humid, high in the mid-80s. Isolated storms for the weekend, near 80 Saturday, only upper 60s Sunday. Currently at 77.
Milwaukee Brewer Baseball from WRCE Radio is sponsored by Jones Chevrolet Buick, A&W Restaurant, Badgerland Flooring, Clary Memorial Funeral Home and Cremation Services, Meister Log and Lumber Company, Napa Auto and Truck Parts, Bailey Paint and Decorating, Papa's Trading Post, Pratt Funeral and Cremation Service, Richland Electric Cooperative, Schmidt Woodland Hills, The Shoebox, Walsh's Ace, McFarland's Manufacturing, All-American Do-It Center, and Goplin Insurance.
Listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So this is what they're calling one of the most historic conventions, because we could have the first woman president in the history of the country, and also the first black woman in the history of the country. And then look, this is representative of the country. This is going to give people, anyone can be president. And that's a great thing. That is a historic thing. And that's why I've asked Jennifer McClellan to come talk with us. She is the first black congresswoman from Virginia. She represents Virginia's 4th congressional district, I believe. Jennifer, thanks for sitting down with us.
Thank you for having me.
So let's start with the big part, the big part first. We got a black woman at the top of the ticket. That's kind of a big deal.
It is a big deal, and it is, you know, she stands on the shoulders of Shirley Chisholm, who I was born the year that Shirley Chisholm ran for office, and it's taken 51 years for us to get here, and I'm just very excited.
So in looking at this convention, is this your first convention?
No. I was here in 1996 as a page, and then I've been a delegate to every convention since. But this is my first one. Yeah.
Wow, you're dating yourself.
I am. That's okay. But this is my first one as a member of Congress.
I can't say compare them, because completely different era.
Yes. Oh, yes.
Completely different Democratic Party.
Yes.
Clinton years. I don't even want to talk about that. No, because for me, the hope and the excitement is that labor is at the heart of what's going on here.
Yes.
Working people issues at the heart of what's going on here.
That's exactly right. And not only that, but, I mean, we have made so much progress with, you know, Joe Biden was probably the most pro-labor president that we had, and Kamala Harris was a partner with him. But there's still a lot of work that we need to do. And, you know, the middle class, labor built the middle class, and this, you know, Kamala Harris and Tim Walz want to focus on building an economy that really centers the middle class and helps raise people into the middle class. And to do that, you know, we need strong unions.
But you know, it's not enough to get Harris Walz elected.
That's right.
We need more of you.
Yes, we do. I need to be in the majority so we can pass the PRO Act. We need the Senate. And people think about the, they only focus on the legislation that we can pass, but I remind everybody, it's the House that certifies elections. It's the Senate that appoints, that confirms Supreme Court justices. And with what the Supreme Court has done, overturning Roe versus Wade, gutting the Voting Rights Act, you know, overturning the Chevron case, which most people are like, why should I care about that? What the Supreme Court has basically done is said, judges will substitute their expertise for
actual experts,
and that should terrify everybody.
Yeah, look, I don't want me having the deciding vote on really complicated stuff. I want people who actually have spent their lives doing that. I certainly don't want a bunch of dictators in robes.
That's right.
Deciding on their ideology more than on facts what happens.
That's right. So there's a lot at stake, but we really need to have not only the White House, but the House and the Senate. And I would argue, you know, there's some states that have state legislative races, governor's races. You need to vote. Every election matters. Every office matters in a government by of and for the people. It only reflects the perspective of and therefore meets the needs of the people who participate. And the first step in that is voting.
Yeah. Now, I look at the House that you're serving in right now. Not real productive. Not much coming out of there. And I got to be honest, I don't know how you do it. And I, every time I talk to a Democratic rep, I don't know how you deal with the insanity, the craziness, and the hey, look at me of the Boberts and the what's that crazy one from Georgia with the three toes or whatever her name is.
I don't say her name.
I mean, the insanity that has become your job.
Yeah.
I don't know how you tolerate that. I don't know how you put up with it. I don't know how you do it.
Well, I'll be honest. I learned transcendental meditation and that helps.
Okay.
Highly recommended.
There you go. Well, I guess whatever gets you through the day, right?
Yeah.
And not.
Well, you know, I'll tell you how I do it. Is I recognize that I am fighting the same fights as my parents, my grandparents, and my great grandparents, but from a position of more strength than they dreamed. I do it because I don't want my children or their children to fight those fights.
And that's every parent, isn't
it? That's every parent.
You know, because I talk about this all the time. My grandparents told me about the fights that they went through to build the labor movement.
Yep.
They were the World War II generation. They came back from overseas fighting fascism to build the most prosperous working class in humanity. Yep. And yes, there are problems with that era, and we will fix that. But it's that togetherness, that fight. You know, they were on picket lines fighting, bleeding, dying for the right, for the eight-hour day, for overtime, for all of the things that are now solidly under attack.
Yeah.
And I don't want my kids to have to fight those fights over again.
That's exactly right. And it's, you know, I'm the first generation of my family to lose a constitutional right in my lifetime. And on every issue, whether it's labor, whether it's freedom, reproductive freedom, whether it's voting, whether it's addressing climate change, every single issue is on the ballot this year, because if Donald Trump gets elected, if we have a Republican House and Senate, they're going to implement Project 2025, which on every issue we care about would roll back progress and would take us to a place that the majority of the American people don't want to go. So there's a lot at stake in this election, but we have a candidate, Kamala Harris and Tim Walz, we have a ticket that gives us something to vote for, not just something to vote against. And no, I'm really excited about
that's
that.
That's the important part of it, isn't it?
Yeah.
Because for too many elections, I'm voting against this person.
Yeah.
And there have been a lot of those exciting moments. And look, I'll be honest, Joe Biden wasn't my first choice. I voted for him because I believed his labor message, and I didn't want Donald Trump.
Yeah.
But, you know, in the primary, not my favorite choice, not my first. But you know what? I now look back and go, he was the right choice.
He was the right choice. You know, time and time again, he dedicated his life to how can I help people and how can I improve the lives of the American people, and didn't take no for an answer, and ultimately saved our democracy, saved our economy. And I'm just extraordinarily grateful, not only for the most consequential presidency in my lifetime, but he was kind, which
decent,
and you know, and let me, that matters, because our children are watching. My son was 5 in the 2016 election, and sitting in the back of the car with my husband listening to radio, he just would say, like, Mommy, who is that man and why is he so angry? And, you know, when he realized that Donald Trump was going to be president, like, he was scared.
Yeah.
And he was five. And
look, at the time, I was in my 50s, and I was scared.
Yeah, I was. yeah. But and now, you know, he's 14 now, and he's excited. And I have a 9-year-old daughter. And they're, you know, it's almost like if you can see it, you can achieve it.
Right.
And so they're just very excited.
So you're not one of those creepy cat ladies that J.D. Vance is afraid of?
I'm a dog person.
I'm a dog person,
but,
too. Amen.
But look, everybody, every human being has value. And, whether, you know, some people can't have children.
And some people shouldn't.
And if they don't want to, that's okay. The beauty of America should be that everybody can achieve their dreams and not have somebody else's value system imposed on them and decide whether they have a successful life, however they choose to define it.
No, I think the message out of J.D. Vance's craziness is that maybe we should be able to have the kind of situation that he's got. Like, my mother-in-law wasn't able to take a year off from work to come take care of our children. My wife had to stay at home and do that. We had to make sacrifices to do that.
Yeah.
It would be nice to have some help in child care,
yes.
Pre-K programs,
yes.
a child tax credit to
yes.
deal with poverty. They don't have any of that.
They don't want to. I mean, they want to take us back.
Yeah.
I always ask, when you say make America great again, when was it great? And for them, I think it was when the only options for most women, and particularly women of color, were these, you know, taking care of somebody else's kids or taking care of your kids and not doing anything but supporting, you know, your husband if you had one.
Well, as I always say, what they want to do is they want to put women back in the kitchen, gays
yes.
back in the closet, and,
yes.
and blacks back, and minorities back in the field.
That's right. That's
and
right.
that's the reality.
Yeah.
So when you talk about, you know, reproductive rights and you talk about women's issues, which have got to be front and center in this election.
Yes.
You know, and I look at how creepy the other side is. You know, as a parent of two daughters, I don't want them to live in that crazy kind of world.
You know, I almost died giving birth to my daughter. And I had the peace of mind going into the emergency room of knowing my doctor is going to make whatever decision she feels is best in that moment and not have to worry about is she going to get arrested for it. And knowing that my daughter might not have that same peace of mind and that same freedom when she reaches childbearing years is heartbreaking to me. And so I'm fighting for her. I'm fighting for the families that want to have children and can't other than through in vitro fertilization, or the ones that don't and therefore they need access to contraception. But more importantly, and you touched on it, I'm fighting for those families that when they do have children, they need childcare that's affordable and accessible, and they need to make sure their children can go to school and not be, you know, afraid they're going to be shot.
Yeah.
So it's almost like you want to impose your decision on whether, when, and how someone becomes a parent, but once they become a parent, you don't want to do anything to help support.
No, and I really thought after Roe went down that some of the true conservatives, or the ones that they believe are true conservatives, would come forth with some of that legislation, saying, yeah, we're going to make women have children, but we're going to help. There's going to be a little bit of something. There's none of that.
Let me tell you, in Congress, when they're trying to cut programs that feed children in school who otherwise would go hungry, you really got to wonder what their values
are. You
got to
wonder what their values are.
Yeah,
I went pro-life my behind. But Jennifer McClellan, I appreciate you taking time for us.
Absolutely.
I hope you'll come back and talk with us again.
Would love to. Thank you.
Great stuff. Virginia's Congresswoman from the 4th Congressional District. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@therickssmithshow.com. Going to take a quick break right back here in Chicago at the Democratic Convention.
Saving work in America, one show at a time. The Rick Smith Show.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1977. That was the day that is remembered in Youngstown, Ohio as Black Monday. The Youngstown Sheet and Tube Company announced plans to close its doors, laying off more than 4,000 workers. Youngstown was a steel town. During the first half of the 20th century, plants were booming. Youngstown was also a union town, a stronghold for the United Steelworkers by the 1940s. But by the 1970s, the once booming steel industry was going bust in Youngstown. More and more jobs moved overseas and to states with less union protections. Black Monday began a devastating series of plant closings. 2 years later, Briar Hill Mill closed, followed in 1980 by U.S. Steel. In 1985, it was Republic Steel's turn. By the early 1990s, the steel industry, which had once employed 40,000 people, only had 1,000 workers left in Youngstown. William Lawson, the executive director of the Mahoning Valley Historical Society, recalled the impact of the closings, saying, quote, "Over the course of my high school career, many boys and girls I had known in grade school left, some in the middle of school years, most during the summers, as their parents accepted transfers to work in other plants around the country or lost their jobs and went out in search of employment elsewhere." In 1997, the Jeanette furnace at the shuttered Briar Hill plant was dynamited, despite preservationists' efforts to save it. Bringing down the Sweet Jenny furnace became symbol of Youngstown's economic ruin, memorialized in this Bruce Springsteen song.
Here in Youngstown.
Like what you hear? Check out more at laborhistoryin2.com.
Sweet Jenny, I'm sinking down. Here, darling, Youngstown.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So it's one of the things I love about these conventions, you get to run into folks who are doing great work. And I look at the city of Baltimore, my wife, kids, we spend a lot of time down in the harbor. The aquarium, one of my wife's favorite places. And that's why I'm excited to talk to the mayor of Baltimore. I'll give him some props on how well they've done with keeping my kids' attention. Brendan Scott is the mayor of Baltimore. Thanks for sitting down with us.
Thank you. Thanks for having me, Rick.
So like I said, great aquarium. My wife and kids love it. It's one of those destination places that has done very well for us.
Anytime. Come on down. Make sure they go to Port Discovery, too. That's another good one, the Maryland Science Center. There's always something to do, and you can get the best seafood in the world while you're there.
Yeah, no, as mayor, you got to get out there promoting what the city's got.
Yeah, you got to come on down.
Tourism is a big thing.
Yes, it is. Come down for the Browns versus Ravens. That'll be the
best time. You're going to go there, are you?
I'm at every game, every home game. And depending on the schedule, I might be coming up to Cleveland this year. Me and Mayor Bibb have been talking about doing that for the last couple of years, so.
So already, I'm going to pick at the wound, are you?
It's no wound to pick. We know how you guys felt. It happened to us. It actually happened to us 11 days before I was born. But
No.
I know how you feel. No hurt on our side. We know. Now you have a team again, so we're all good. Good rivalry, too.
Okay, well, if you say so. Let's talk about something we can agree on.
Yes.
There we go. See, the ultimate politician.
That's right.
Finding that common ground.
That's right. We're not Pittsburgh. There's nothing worse than a Steeler. We're not here to talk about that today.
Let's talk about what we can't agree on. What do you think of this this little shindig? Your first, second, tenth?
This is my third convention. I'm a delegate, for the Harris campaign. The energy is amazing. We saw something last night that you typically don't see in politics. You saw someone pass the baton. And as someone who had to snatch the baton from a generation before me, I was amazed and really, really, really taken aback by the president's his dignity, his grace, but his patriotism.
Yeah.
And yes, everyone knows that I love my president. I thank him for not all just the support and things that he's done for my city, but for me personally and the mentorship. But to see someone do that and for us to literally be able to give him his flowers while he's here,
right,
and him to say, yes, we've accomplished all of these things, but now we have to elect her. our Vice President, Kamala Harris, to see that work through was a historic thing, and I think that we'll look back on that in years and understand even more what that means.
No, I've been saying this is what gets him on Mount Rushmore, because this is that heroic act, that selfless act of saving democracy, because we don't know how the election's going to turn out, but I fear from that Thursday debate, it was not going to... Look, I love Joe Biden. I love Uncle Joe, Jelly Bucket Joe, all the names I've got for him, a guy who shows up and does the job, but it didn't look good.
And we now know that the energy, as Jaylen Brown said, the momentum is about to shift, and it has shifted in a monumentous way with the energy behind the Vice President, and now we're going to see that take off so that we can save this democracy.
Let's talk about the legacy. Now, you said the President Biden has done a lot for the city of Baltimore. There's a lot of investments on infrastructure, a lot of investments on reshoring manufacturing, just doing a lot of really great stuff. Walk me through some of the stuff that has the city of Baltimore has benefited from.
Well, I think that I always take back to what people think about. When people see my city, they think The Wire, right? So we are now talking about a city of Baltimore that President Biden's White House is now using as an example for cities around the country on how to tackle gun violence. And when you think about that deep partnership, being a part of that first group of mayors that met with him and them allowing us to invest into violence prevention, into focusing around guns, into all the things that play into this public health issue called gun violence. That is partially how we've been able to reduce homicides by 20% in Baltimore from 2022 to 2023, the largest reduction ever. And we're beating that this year with another 29% reduction. $50 million of investment into our comprehensive violence prevention strategy from this president and vice president. When you look at that work, when you look at how we've been standing up our job training programs and our career programs, when you look at the work that we've done through infrastructure, we're going to get a brand new Frederick Douglass Tunnel for Amtrak that the president and people say we're the favorites because the president came through Baltimore each and every day on Amtrak. Well, favoritism is okay with me. But when you think about what that's going to mean for Baltimore now, making the train ride from Baltimore to D.C., about 27 minutes, right?
Wow.
That kind of investment. And then, of course, the president showing up as we knew he would when we had the unthinkable tragedy of the Key Bridge and saying that we will be here to support this city and this state throughout this process because this port is so important to all of America.
No, it's one of the main ports in the country, and getting that open again is, you know, paramount. How is the bridge rebuild going?
It's going.
Done with project labor agreement with prevailing wage and all that?
We know that in Maryland we believe in that kind of stuff, and we know that this president does, and what our congressional folks say that they think that they're close to getting the deal done, and we will get that bridge, that process going. And this is a perfect example for the rest of the country, how everyone can work together. From the president, President Biden, from his administration, from Governor Westmore, all the way down to myself and the county executives, working lockstep together, everyone doing their respective job to make sure that the constituents and those who depend on that bridge and depend on that port get what they need in the fastest way possible. And we would not be here without that example. I'll tell you this story. We had the Appropriations Committee, House Appropriations Committee, on a boat with the governor and I a few months back, and we heard time and time again that they've been through so many of these tragedies, but they've never seen the cooperation and the partnership through all levels of government like this, and we want to continue to say that because it's important for folks to know that's how you do the job.
Well, you need a functional government.
There you
need
go.
People
that's
who believe,
how you do the
you
job.
Need people who believe in government for you to have a functional government.
Yes.
That seems pretty simple. Now, what I would like the Key Bridge to be built much like they did with the Tappan Zee, as opposed to what we saw at the Bay Bridge in California.
Yeah.
The Tappan Zee, we know, built on time with a project labor agreement, with union labor, created good jobs, on time, under budget. I want that, not what we saw the debacle in California, where they said, no, we're not going to do that prevailing wage stuff. We're going to piece this out.
I'll just say, like my president, and as the grandson of a UAW worker and a former UFCW food worker, my mom, who is still one today, we know that union labor gets the job done right. It benefits our families. I would not be here talking to you if it were not for my granddad working at General Motors in Baltimore, and we have to push that. And I know that if I have any say and if the president have any say, it will be done that way, and we just hope that it is.
No, and look, your story is the story of, you know, millions of people. This idea that a job is going to create opportunities for future generations. Sadly, most of those jobs are gone.
Yeah.
The idea of reshoring manufacturing, which is a key tenet of what the Biden administration is working on, could benefit places like Baltimore, yep. places like Toledo, Ohio, places like Eau Claire, Wisconsin. There are opportunities to make cities like Baltimore the places that are going to be the heart and soul of this country again.
And that's what we have to do. And we have to understand that we have to change and we have to do innovation. And for us in Baltimore, it's going to be manufacturing. It's going to be tech. Obviously, it's going to be ads and meds with Hopkins and tourism and all those things. But we have to, with that port and where we sit, we have to make sure that we understand how important that is. And we have to have those careers there for folks to be able to support their families for generations.
No, it's incredible that somebody as young as you are who gets it and who's ready to take on and lead, and as you have done an amazing job of. And look, Baltimore gets a bad rap sometimes, but the reality is I've seen some really good things coming out of your area.
Yes, sir. Thank you very much. Thank you.
So, you know, last line of questioning I've got, you know, because out of here, there's a lot of hope, a lot of energy, this idea to continue on things like you have done. What are you thinking is the bounce out of here from now to Election Day? What are you hoping for?
What I'm hoping for is that everyone joins us in that movement, in that moment, right? That we all now know what we have to do. And the vice president is going to give us our charge on Thursday. We now have to go out and execute. They are on the run. He is running scared, literally running scared from the vice president. We have to keep the pedal to the metal, our foot on their throats for the remainder of this campaign, reminding people of the choice that you have. Do you want a dictator, or do you want a president who will lead for our people and our country? Do you want someone who doesn't care about working people, who doesn't care about women, who doesn't care about people of color, who doesn't care about rules, even the U.S. Constitution? Or do you want someone who has proven time and time again through every level of service that she has that she will operate in the best interest of the people first, and who also just happens to be the vice president, who was a part of an administration with President Biden that accomplished things that will rival any presidency, any vice presidency, and during a pandemic, no less. That's the choice. It's very simple. We have to go out, deliver that message, beat it into everyone's brain, because this is the most important election, because they're telling you what they're going to do, and you should believe them.
No, look, I can see why you're the mayor. You are fantastic at this. I appreciate you taking time for us. Keep up the fight, and I'd love to have you back again real soon.
Anytime. Go Ravens.
Now. Going to take a quick break. Right back after this. Stick around. This is The Rick Smith Show.
One show at a time. The Rick Smith Show.
Thanks for tuning in to The Rick Smith Show. Be sure to follow us on Twitter at Rick Smith Show, like us on Facebook, Instagram, and subscribe to our YouTube channel. You can find all that and much more at TheRickSmithShow.com.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
Gotta tell you, I really like Baltimore Mayor Brendan Scott. Good guy, smart young guy. Going to have a bright future in politics in Maryland. And look, you know, the fact that a city like Baltimore has problems, but you've got a young guy who's going, hey, we can have solutions. And doing that ground level grassroots organizing, bringing communities together. Look, you know, it's a huge departure from where we started today's program off of, you know, corporate America ripping us apart. Baltimore is another example of that. And, you know, again, once a very, you know, thriving manufacturing area, still has some manufacturing, but not like it had been. And the idea of having a government that is interested in manufacturing, has a manufacturing policy, Wow. And not just words for it. Look, I go back to Trump. We had infrastructure week every week. There were manufacturing week all the time. Didn't do anything, but we talked about it a lot. Joe Biden did something about it. And this is where my hope is that Kamala Harris will be the one who picks it up and moves it forward even farther. So that places that used to be places like Youngstown, places like Akron or Cleveland, where I grew up, or Baltimore, that those places are places that are going to be, that are the future of solid, prosperous working class jobs. We can do it. We've done it in the past. Wonder if we'll do it again. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, Rick at TheRickSmithShow.com. You miss any portion of the program, grab the podcast. Wherever you get your favorite podcast, you'll find ours. And as always, thanks so much for being here. We'll see you back here next time.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Email Rick. At Rick at TheRickSmithShow.com.
This is News from the Center, 1450 AM WRCE and 107.7 FM W299 CD Richland Center. And always on the Civic Media app.